Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm so happy to be with all of you today. I have a great show planned. My guest will be Michaela Colley, who is the Program Director for the Organic Seed Alliance, and she'll be coming on in a little bit. But first, I want to tell you some things going on in around the news, some things you can participate in, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. Well, this is a new year, and Trump is, you know, still up to his usual ruin the environment and politics and everything as we know it. So there's lots of take actions that I would like to make you aware of. You know, first, of course, Jeff Sessions is trying to make the states that have legalized marijuana become illegal. And so I have a petition on my website to try to keep marijuana, the states that have decided to have marijuana be legal, that they should be allowed to decide on that on their own, which has been something that has been in place since the Obama administration. The Organic Consumer Association is also asking us to stop Trump's attack on organic animal welfare rules. And they are trying to undo rules that have protected chickens mainly to have access to outdoor space and to decent living environments. We all have seen those pictures of the chickens crammed into indoor space, and they're still allowed to be called organic. And so there's certain standards that they need to follow, and the Trump administration is trying to do away with those rules. So it's called Organic Animal Welfare Rules, and there's a petition on my website for that, if you could help. Also, Puerto Rico, Bernie Sanders has introduced a bill to help support Puerto Rico. Believe it or not, still one-third of the island's power is out. Many, many people still do not have access to clean water. It's just, you know, thousands have been displaced. It's just a horrible situation there. So many people, I was listening to this morning on NPR, they're talking about the schools having to close, the ones that have reopened because there's not enough students, because so many people have left the island to head for Florida. I've heard stories on NPR about hospitals not being able to get all the blood bags that they need for intravenous use. I guess they're made in Puerto Rico and those factories haven't been opened yet. Anyway, we need to help Puerto Rico. There's a petition on my website for that as well. And then this is a big one. Congress right now is working on the 2018 Farm Bill. The Farm Bill controls so many things that we hold dear to our hearts. We'll be talking about that later with my guest, Michaela, in how the Farm Bill helps support the Organic Seed Alliance. But anyway, they are right now trying to cut the organic cost share program, which helps organic farms stay in business, and especially for small and mid-sized farms. And we need to help support these organic farms, which also supports our regional economies. And if this part of the bill is cut, it really would be bad. So this is the certification cost share program. We do not want that to be cut, and there is a petition for that, and there's actually phone numbers for you to call your senators and your representatives to let them know that you want to protect that cost share program. And then there's also a bill to protect wildlife and our water. As I'm sure you've all heard, Trump has opened up our shoreline for offshore drilling. Of course, Florida, where he has Mar-a-Lago has been exempt from this new rule. But anyway, he's opening up the shores all across the country, the Gulf of Mexico, the Pacific, the Atlantic, and what that will do to everything, our local economies, the fish, the wildlife, the businesses that depend on it, tourism. I mean, it's just so stupid, so short-sighted, and it's all for corporate profit. None of it's good for the people. It's just unbelievable. It's so clearly misguided. It's just unbelievable that we allow him to get away with this, and we can't let him get away with this. So we need to all make a commitment in this new year to really stand up against that, because it's just so, so bad. Okay, some things going on in and around the city that you might be interested in. Oco Farms, which is a wonderful farm in Brooklyn. I interviewed the founder of Oco Farms. They're having an introduction to aquaponics and aquaculture this Saturday. The cost is $85 if you're interested. You can find the link on my website at iegreen.com or go to Oco, O-K-O Farms. And you'll find information on that. Also this Saturday, I'm having a cooking class here at the IE Green Homestead from 11 to 2. That's $89, and I am focusing on meals that can be prepared and then portioned out and frozen. I've had a lot of requests for people who are working parents who want to be able to make meals ahead of time and freeze them. So these are all vegan and gluten-free dishes that can be frozen well and pulled out in the midweek for an easy meal. So there's still space in that class if you're interested. Also that evening, January 13th, there's the Sounds of Liberation Christian Das Benefit Concert with lots of other guests at the Church of St. Paul and St. Andrew in the city. I believe it's a fundraiser. I believe it's sold out. You may be able to find a single ticket here or there if you're interested in going to that. Also on the 13th, big day. This is at 5 o'clock. Actually, I think this has a typo. It's Friday, so I think it's tomorrow evening. Chef's Lab Dinner Series, and that's being sponsored by Edible Brooklyn. And this is a dinner series that they're starting up in Sunset Park. It should be fun. They are highlighting Chef Winston Chu of Bon Bite Catering and Little Tong, which was written up recently in the New York Times. So that is $75 per person and includes food and wine. And then on January 15th, Monday, St. Martin Luther King Day, IE Green is also giving a cooking class at the Westbury Library. And this class is only $5. The library sponsors it, and it is a vegetarian cooking class. We'll be making jambalaya, vegan and gluten-free jambalaya, and vegetable curry kinoto, which is like a risotto but made with quinoa. So come down to the Westbury Library. They do ask you to register first because there is limited space, so check that out. January 17th, there is a sustainable film series that Molloy College sponsors every month, and this is called Food Evolution. It's supposedly a great documentary. It takes a takes a look at the critical question facing the world today of food security, and demonstrates that the need for food is global and needs to really meet everybody's needs. So it should be a really great film. They offer a vegan buffet dinner beforehand. The cost is $10, but nobody will be turned away at the door. If you can't afford it, you can still come in. Food and Water Watch is having a resistance meeting at the Ethical Culture Society, the New York City Ethical Culture Society, on West 64th Street on January 18th. Food and Water Watch is one of the organizations that I do a lot of work with. They're a great organization, really looking out to protect our food security and diversity and our clean water. So this is a discussion really to highlight getting off of fossil fuels campaign and renewable energy. So if you can make it to that, that would be great. And then the winter conference is coming up. NOFA, New York's winter conference, which stands for the Northeast Organic Farming Association. Their winter conference is January 19th through the 21st. It's really a great, great event. You know, this is when farmers have the time to come out and really meet with other farmers and people who care about the food movement. And we're all coming together. There's workshops all day long. There's lots of social events as well. Great food. A lot of farmers donate a lot of their food to making these great meals. And I will be doing a cooking class there on Friday. So come to that if you can make it. And also that same weekend, January 20th, is the Women's March in New York. That will be taking place all around the country and possibly around the world. I know there's, you know, all the major cities are going to be having marches, certainly D.C., New York, L.A., but even Seneca Falls, upstate New York, they'll have a march as well. So, and I know my sister's doing one in New Jersey, so they're everywhere. So check out the Women's March if you're not going to be up at the conference. And it really pains me that I'll be missing this one, but I need to be at this conference. So march for me, please. And January 25th, there is an evening with chef and biochemist Dr. Ali Buzari at the Boulay Botanical. Boulay Botanical is a great new event space. Chef David Boulay, it's part of his new vision along with his home cooked restaurant. So that's on January 25th if you're interested. And all of these movie screenings and events are all listed on my website under events at IE Green. So you can check them out. On January 28th, there's a screening of An Inconvenient Sequel. That's Al Gore's second movie. Really great. I saw it. It's really worthwhile. And on January 29th, Slow Food New York City is having their annual Food Almanac, which is a great event. I go to it every year. This time, though, it's at the Project Farmhouse, which is a new great food event space in the city on East 13th Street. So check out the Food Almanac Conference in New York City. It's a great opportunity to come together with other food activists and hear about different farming policy changes that affect all of us. So, and there's more, but I don't want to take the time because I do want to share my recipe with you and get my guest on. So right now, the recipe I made this week, with all that cold weather, all I wanted to eat was soup. Soup, soup, soup. So this is a black lentil and tomato squash soup. You know, when it's cold outside, your body just knows that you need these warming foods, and this is that. So start with 3 cups of black lentils rinsed. I have 9 cups of water down here, but I actually ended up adding a couple more cups of water just to thin it out a little bit. So you can start with 9 cups of water. You know, that makes it more like a stew, and then if you want it to be a little more soupy, you can add a little bit more water. 2 tablespoons of vegetable broth powder. I used a Seitenbacher, which is is new to me. A friend turned me on to it. It's very nice, but it's a powder of mostly organic vegetables. It doesn't have any malt dextrose or dextrose in it, which is a common ingredient in some of the other vegetable broths that you'll find. 1 onion chopped, 6 cloves garlic, 3 tablespoons minced ginger, 2 cups of chopped carrots. Some carrots are really big and some are small, so every once in a while I decide to, like, measure it. That was 3 to 4 carrots because the carrots are small, but if you have big carrots, it would probably just be 2. But anyway, 2 cups of chopped carrots, 2 cups of squash. I had an acorn squash in my refrigerator because part of it had been going bad, so I just cut it away, and so I measured that too, and it was 2 cups worth cut up. 1 teaspoon fenugreek, 1 can diced fire-roasted tomatoes, 2 tablespoons chopped hot peppers. I had a habanero, I had a jalapeno, but I measured that out for 2 tablespoons. 3 teaspoons salt, 1/2 teaspoon white pepper, 1 1/2 teaspoons cardamom, 1 teaspoon ground coriander, 1 teaspoon cumin, 2 to 4 tablespoons chopped cilantro. If you're one of those that doesn't like cilantro, you can substitute parsley. And 2 tablespoons of red wine vinegar, which I added at the end just to give it a little acid and make it pop. And so I started in a large pot. I rinsed the lentils first and then added them to the pot and added water and just turned it on. And I added the squash, the onions, the garlic, the ginger, peppers, and carrots to that. Then I added all of the spices to that, and I brought it to a boil. Now, in the years past, you know, usually I saute my vegetables first before going into this pot of soup, and you certainly can do that. But in the new year, I've been trying to cook with a little bit less oil. So if you notice, this recipe has no oil in it. So, you know, that's up to you. If you wanted to saute the vegetables first in a little oil, you certainly can. But it came out delicious without any oil, so it's just that much better. And I simmered them for about an hour until the lentils got soft. And actually, it was even a little longer. I don't know if because my lentils were older, but black lentils are harder than the usual green and red lentils, so they definitely took longer to cook. And you can add more water, as I said before, if it's too thick for you. Then you add the red wine vinegar and the cilantro towards the end. And then taste it. You can adjust for the salt and pepper. And then I didn't want the soup fully pureed. I wanted there to be some texture to it, but I did want it to be a little thicker. So I pureed half of it with an immersion blender. And I put the blender just into the pot and pureed it until it was the consistency I wanted. And that's it. You can serve it with a lemon wedge and garnish it with some more fresh cilantro or parsley. And that's it. Comes together super quick, super easy, and really delicious and so warming for the body. So enjoy that. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest to all of you, Michaela Coley. She leads the Organic Seed Alliance's research and education programs, which focuses on seed production and organic plant breeding. She's the author of several publications, and she frequently teaches and speaks on organic seed topics and collaborates on research projects nationally. Currently, she's pursuing a PhD focused on organic and participatory plant breeding under Dr. Edith Lammerts van Buren at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. I know I said that wrong. You can fix it for me, Michaela. Are you with me?
I'm here. Good morning, Bhavani.
Good morning, Michaela. How are you? And how do you say the university you're going to?
Oh, I probably won't hit it on the nose either, but it's Wageningen. University in Holland.
I knew I didn't have it right. Anyway, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Sure. So can you share with my listeners first how you got interested in organic seed saving?
Sure. You know, I grew up, you know, working in the garden with my family and enjoying all of the livelihood aspects that come with gardening. And so as I got into my 20s and started looking for what I wanted to be when I grew up, I fell in love with working on organic farms, and I worked on a organic farm in California in the very, very early 90s that grew flowers and greens. And every winter, I loved curling up by the fire like we all do and searching through the seed catalogs and picking out what we were going to grow the next year. Well, we were an organic flower farm in the early, early 90s when flowers, you know, organic was still being established as a sector of agriculture and was not yet even run by the USDA. And so there was certainly very, very few choices for organic seed of flowers. And it just always felt like this gap to me. Why are we organic farmers, but we buy conventional seed? And, of course, the few catalogs that were out there were packet size scale. So the woman that I worked for, the flower farmer, Four Sisters Farm, she would always let me pick out a few of the organic seed packets and buy them at garden seed prices regardless. But it always just felt like this sort of a gap in the trueness of the organic production system that we were embracing. And so when I went back to school, I pursued my degree in horticulture, and I wanted to be a jack of all trades because I wanted to be a farmer. So I wanted to study soil science. I wanted to study pathology, entomology. I needed to know everything to be a farmer. And with a master's degree in horticulture, even in a program that was very focused on agroecology, I never took a class on seed. So by the time I graduated, I still realized that I knew very, very little about seed. You learn plant propagation, but all you learn is how to buy the seed and then plant it. So this sort of drove my curiosity about where does the seed come from? It just comes from the catalog in the packet, right? And so after I graduated, I found a job working for an organic seed company and started learning really from the ground up, mostly from the farmers that grew for that company, because the knowledge of seed is so tightly held to the practitioners and to the industry that manages that seed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's fascinating. You know, it's you talk about not knowing about where a seed comes from. You know, it's like, you know, you all hear about the stories of, you know, little kids, you know, where does your vegetables come from? And it's like the supermarket, you know, or,
right.
You know, they have no idea how it's grown. And it's true. People don't think about, you know, where the seed actually comes from. I remember when I first started my garden and I was doing all organic, you know, I heard, you know, planting marigolds around the flowers were, I mean, around the garden was good to keep bugs away. But then I was just, you know, you couldn't find organic marigolds already started. So I was just buying marigolds in the regular, regular garden center. And then, you know, stopped to really think about what that was in the soil. And, you know, and then I'm just contaminating all my soil if I do that. So I had to find organic marigold seeds and grow them from start, you know, from seed, which I wasn't always doing. So it's interesting, you know, as we learn, you know, each step of the way, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. And why is it so important to save seeds? I mean, why can't we just keep buying them from seed companies?
Well, seed companies do play an important role in ensuring that we have access to seed, and seed companies are truly the stewards of our seed in many, many ways, and the decision makers about what's available in terms of the seed that we have to plant. But participating by saving your own seed or becoming a seed farmer even, on a fundamental level, is important for your own self-sufficiency and access to seed that is adapted to your environment, that has the quality traits that you need and want for your farm or that your customer wants. And a lot of farmers that we work with at Organic Seed Alliance initially get excited about learning how to grow seed because they've been frustrated by not being able to source seed that works well for their farm. Or when they do have a variety that works really well, one year you go to the seed catalog and it's gone. And it was dropped perhaps because your climate and the type of production you're in is not a big enough market share for that seed company to continue carrying it. And so a lot of farmers have been driven to start saving seed working with us just out of that fundamental self-sufficiency. But I would call that a base level reason why to save seed. When you start engaging in seed saving, you become part of those decision makers about what seed is important, what genetics are going to be stewarded into the future. And this is an important step in participating in preservation of diversity and increasing biodiversity of our food crops. So there's this fundamental act of self-sufficiency that also contributes to the resiliency of our whole agricultural system and food systems as humans. And as you start to save seed, you also learn that your choices in what plants you save seed from in your location is also helping those crops become better adapted to your environment. So you're selecting the individual plants that have the greatest fitness for survival under your particular garden or farm conditions. So this is, I always say seed saving becomes the gateway to becoming a plant breeder. And as soon as you start saving seed, you are engaging in that fundamental act of stewarding genetics forward, which is really how our food crops became domesticated from wild plants over 10,000 years ago. Last point I might make, and so this is important in terms of stewardship of genetic resources, not just for your region, but engaging in that fundamental act of seed saving is important on a global level in terms of the preservation of crop genetic diversity. And in fact, farmers who save seed internationally make up an important network of seed conservation stewards, specialists. And in our country, we still have, for the most part, the legal power to save seed. as long as a crop variety is not patented with restrictive patents that prevent you from saving seed. And in fact, a vast majority of the seeds that you buy from your garden catalog are not patented, and it is legal to save the seed from those varieties. And so I think that saving seed is a fundamental exercise of that power. And there's sort of this act of exercising your powers that ensure that you are able to keep those powers. If we quit saving seed, we're not going to notice when we're no longer allowed legally to save seed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but it used to be illegal to patent a seed, right? Life was not patentable. And somewhere along the line, I think during the Clinton administration possibly, Monsanto got the power to patent their seed because of the genetic modification that they did to it. Is that, do I have that correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was a Clinton item. I don't quite want to be quoted. It was in the 80s, so it might have been as far back as Reagan. I'm not sure of the year. But regardless, yes, that's true. A utility patent is different than a plant variety protection patent. And a PVP, plant variety protection, is what was in place from the 70s, or I think it started in the 60s, into the 70s, became a way for plant breeders to protect the intellectual property, the investment of research that they put into developing a new variety, so that they would be able to gain the economic benefit of commercializing that variety. But a PVP still allowed farmers to save their own seed and plant breeders to access the genetics within that variety to breed something new. So it wasn't a bottleneck in the ability for our food crops to continue to co-evolve and be bred into new varieties. And so, yes, that's true. And it was really in fairly recent history, if you put it into that context of the last 40 years, that we have increasingly had this trend toward varieties having utility patents, which include language about farmers not being able to save that seed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's important to remember that's a recent history. So it's happened very quickly, but it doesn't have to be that way, if you put it that way.
Right. And like you said, it happens, and if people aren't aware of it, it happens without people knowing about it. Even like the whole introduction of genetically modified products, nobody told us that that was happening. It kind of just happened, and people weren't paying attention. And next thing you know, the majority or a lot of our foods are genetically modified, and we didn't even know that was taking place, you know. They kind of sneak it in there. So what's happened to seed diversity in this country? I mean, you know, I'm part of the slow food movement, and, you know, there's all these heirloom seeds and the Arc of Taste movement, which is really trying to bring back more biodiversity into our food choices. What has happened? Why do we have so little seed diversity in this country, and is it the same globally?
Well, in this country and globally, there's been an increasing trend since the 50s, 60s, 70s, and increasing quite rapidly in the 80s, around that time that you were referencing with the advent of patenting. There's a trend toward larger seed companies globally buying up smaller seed companies and consolidating into larger and larger singular corporate control of seed and therefore of our food crops. And what happens when a large seed company buys a smaller one, generally they go through the inventory of that smaller seed company and drop anything that doesn't have a large enough market share. So if you're a very large global seed company, you want to invest your research and development dollars into breeding varieties that work well either in an area where you have a large-scale agricultural production or a variety that works sort of well in a lot of places. And so you there's a tendency toward reducing the diversity of varieties that are available commercially. That has certainly happened in several studies have kind of looked at that loss of genetic diversity within our food crops. I also am heartened by the fact that, you know, from the 1970s but into the 80s and 90s, parallel with this trend toward consolidation and loss of genetic diversity of our food crops, we've also had growth in local food movement and in the organic food movement, which is a model where we're striving to increase diversity of our food crops within a region so that we have more access to local and regionally produced seed. And along with that comes the necessity to have genetic diversity, to have crops and varieties that are adapted to all of the regions where we, where our local food is supported by our local communities. And so with that, there are a number of nonprofit organizations, small seed companies, for-profit seed companies, that have strived to increase that genetic diversity. And some of this has gone parallel with bringing back the heirlooms that you mentioned. And in the last 20 years, there's also been a movement toward not just preserving heirlooms from the past, but preserving the culture that created those heirlooms and training people to save their own seed and start developing new varieties that can be handed down to the next generation. And that's an exciting trend of increasing our genetic diversity and going back to the act of seed saving that we were just talking about, a way that it's certainly fundamental to why seed saving is important and going back to that point of increasing genetic diversity. So there are many new, you know, seed libraries have grown across the country. Seed savers that are connected through networks like Seed Savers Exchange, and then farmers and gardeners that participate in the kind of trainings that OSA offers to actually create new varieties or improve our heirlooms, because our ancestors that created those heirlooms never intended them for them to become completely stagnant. They were always getting improved, and this is something we have the power to increase our participation in into the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know I've also heard of, like, the international seed banks, like up in, Iceland or...
Norway.
Where?
It's in Norway.
Norway.
The Svalbard Seed Vault is in Norway, yes.
Uh-huh. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, well, worldwide, we have international centers of seed conservation, which we call seed banks, and they're very, very important in conserving genetic diversity, protecting genetic diversity. It's what we call in situ or ex situ conservation, when you save something in a bank, in a box, on the shelf, and it's an important way to preserve diversity of our food crops. But the other side of that is that those genetic resources are always at some risk seed doesn't last in a box forever. It has to be regenerated eventually. And the Svalbard Seed Vault was created in Norway because it's a very good environment for conserving seed longer term. That internationally, when you're in a tropical climate or a politically unstable climate like the seed bank that was lost in Syria, which was quite tragic, those genetic resources are at high risk, either from degradation from being in warm, moist climates where seed doesn't store very well, or in locations where the seed itself is not safe. So those are important efforts, but conservation ex situ in seed banks really needs to go hand in hand with preservation in the field by keeping seed alive in growing and saving and regenerating our genetic diversity every year. And that's the role that an international network of farmer stewards and gardener stewards are really doing to complement the seed bank conservation efforts.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. And can you also share with us what's the difference between crossbreeding and genetically modified? Because I know, you know, so often people use, you know, talk about crossbreeding and people are like, oh, no, I don't want any GMOs. And I'm like, that's not GMOs.
Right.
So can you share that with my listeners a little bit?
Sure, sure. And by the same token, a lot of proponents of genetic engineering will also try to convince people that it's simply the same thing as crossbreeding or seed saving. Okay, let me get back to your question quickly and just answer that as concisely as I can, and then we can talk about it. So the fundamental difference between genetic engineering and traditional classical plant breeding, as we call it, is that in genetic engineering, you're manipulating the genome by actually moving genes from one location to another, or from one plant to another, from one species to another, even across kingdoms in the case of extracting fish DNA and putting them into strawberries as the as an example of a very wide genetic engineering difference of taking a gene from an entity that never would have had that gene in the first place in nature and putting it into another species. So when you say crossbreeding, this is really, if you think about the natural process of the evolution of our plant species, plants naturally cross-pollinate in the field. They naturally cross-pollinate in nature, meaning that the pollen from one plant pollinates or lands on the stigma of another plant, and then the offspring has some combination of the genetics from the mother plant and the father plant, just like we do as humans, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we do as seed savers and as plant breeders is we steward those varieties or those individual plants that have crossed forward, either by intentionally crossing them. I mean, we're talking about crossing that would happen in nature, but you assist it by moving the pollen from one plant to another, not extracting genes from one plant and sticking them into another plant. And then growing out those offspring, growing out the seed that came from that cross, and evaluating and selecting and saving seed from the individual offspring that have the combination of genetic qualities from the mother plant and the father plant that you desired as a farmer or gardener. And so that's the fundamental skills of understanding the laws of genetic inheritance and the biology of plants and how they naturally cross is the foundation of classical plant breeding, and that's what we teach at Organic Seed Alliance.
Mm. And to transfer pollen from one to the other, is that done under a microscope in like a lab type of environment, or is it something that one can just do in their garden shed?
It depends on the species. Some crops, like corn, as a prime example, you know, corn, the tassels have the pollen way up at the top of the plant, and the silks, the ear of the corn, is the female portion of the plant that receives that pollen. So this is a crop that's evolved in nature to be pollinated by wind, where the wind blows all that pollen. If you've ever been in a cornfield in the middle of summer, you know you get dusted with that sticky pollen all over you. So if you want to cross those two, you can control it by collecting the pollen up on the tassel and then putting it in a bag and then putting that bag over the ear at the appropriate time, and there are YouTube videos you can find through our educational resources to see how to do that. But you can also grow two populations next to each other and let the wind do that. Let the wind freely cross them. Same thing with our insect-pollinated species. We commonly cross them by putting them planted in close proximity with each other and letting that happen naturally. Other species don't cross with each other quite as easily. So lettuce or peas are examples of what we call inbreeding or self-pollinating crops. And so in this case, they've evolved to more readily be pollinated within a single flower. The anthers that carry the male pollen will naturally cross with its own pistil, the female portion. And so in that case, if you want to intentionally cross two different plants, you have to move the pollen from one flower to another flower. And sometimes that can be a little bit tedious, but still Nothing you can't do with a magnifying glass and a pair of tweezers.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the Organic Seed Alliance and some of the programs that you have. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Michaela Colley from the Organic Seed Alliance, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and we'll be right back.
Do you want to know the latest news or upcoming events? Follow us at Twitter at @PRN_radio or click the Twitter icon on our homepage. You can also friend us on Facebook. Just search Progressive Radio Network. Always new and up to date. The Progressive Radio Network, your home for thoughtful and informative information.
Hi, this is John Lobel. You can hear my show Visionaries at 10 a.m. on Mondays on PRN. And guess what? PRN now has its own app. So you've always been able to listen to our shows by going to your web browser and putting in PRN.fm. And then you can listen to the current show that's on air. But you can now download onto your smartphone, Android and iPhone, our PRN browser. Search for it in your app store, and you can listen live to whatever's on at the moment. So download now our PRN.fm app.
We are PRN. 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 Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned. Tuned.
Are you interested in growing a greener future? Do you enjoy healthy, nutritious food? Would you like to learn how to grow your own organic oasis in an easy and efficient way? I'm Jackie Marie Beyer, the humble host of the Organic Gardener podcast, where I talk with amazing guests who are all using sustainable, earth-friendly practices. I interview backyard gardeners, market farmers, and people who have green businesses related to food. I'd love it if you'd join us on the Progressive Radio Network, coming on Monday evenings at 7 p.m.
PRN would like to thank its listeners for making us number one on Zeno Radio's phone service and also the top searched internet radio station on Google. Thank you for helping us move forward.
Hey, it's Paul Cavalcante, host of The Vinyl Experience, bringing you a new spin on a classic technology that just keeps getting bigger. Vinyl records are in, and The Vinyl Experience is the original radio show that tells their backstory, one revolution at a time. Join me Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern on PRN.fm and anytime in the archives.
Crackle, crackle. Pop, pop.
The Vinyl Experience on PRN.fm.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with my guest, Michaela Colley, the Program Director for the Organic Seed Alliance. And we're just getting into talking about some of the programs that the Organic Seed Alliance has. And so, Michaela, I know that the Organic Seed Alliance runs a great internship program. And to do that, I know you partner with MESA, the Multinational Exchange for Sustainable Agriculture. Can you tell us about this program and how many people do you train at a time and how does one apply if they're interested?
Sure. Yeah, we were just talking earlier about knowledge around seed saving and how we learn seed saving, and I was sharing that, you know, with a master's in horticulture, I never took a class in seed. Well, I have to credit the farmers that I know for being my mentors, my trainers in the knowledge around seed saving. And so much of the information about how to, not only the plant biology, but how you grow seed as a seed crop is really information that is best accessed by engaging with it in the field. And so as a nonprofit educational organization, We've partnered with a number of farmers over the years to host workshops on farms, to train other beginning farmers and interns and students in how to save seed. But seed farms are also spread out geographically across the country. It can be hard to find one of those farms. If you want to learn farming and you want to learn seed, where do you go to make those connections? And so we started an internship program in partnership with Mesa that is really a matchmaking resource so that the seed farms can register as a host farm on the website. And if you're interested in an internship in seed production, then you can fill out a form to register as a prospective intern. And then it's really a matchmaking platform for those intern applicants and the farmers to connect with each other and see where there's a good fit. And then the relationship of taking on an intern is directly between the farmer and the intern. So just to be clear, OSA's then not managing those internship placements, but creating a platform where that networking and matchmaking can happen between those two entities. But what we do to support both the farmer and the intern is also provide online curriculum in seed production, including a series of webinars and many educational manuals that we've developed over the years, and we've put these tools together as a toolkit on the website. So the host farm, who is actually providing the hands-on opportunity, has a basic online curriculum that their interns can go through so that they don't have to go through the tedium of all of the basic training, but they can have a more educated, better prepared intern to come to their farm and continue learning throughout the season with a hands-on work and support of the actual farm operation.
Mm-hmm. And are these online curriculums, are they available to anyone to, like, go to your website and check them out, or do they cost money?
Yes,
how do
they are.
Work?
You can register for free on the internship website, and you can actually take that curriculum, you can take that training, online training, for free without being placed as an intern on a farm. I think the hands-on experience of actually working on a seed farm is incredibly valuable and complementary to the online curriculum, but you can also choose to just follow that curriculum from the comfort of your own home.
Wow, that's a great service. Is there an optimal condition for saving seeds? Like if, you know, people are saving seeds and they just have them out in their garden shed, is that a problem going from, you know, summertime into wintertime, different temperatures, or does it have to be temperature controlled?
Yes, well, seed is a living entity. It is actually respiring and breathing even after you save it off of the plant. And so you want to save seed in a cool, dry environment as much as possible, in an environment where those temperatures are not fluctuating, because every time the temperature goes up and down, the seed begins to respire and then starts to develop condensation. And so it's twofold, that moisture and heat encourage the growth of bacteria and microbes on the seed that start to deteriorate it over time. But it's also simply breathing and using up its resources for storage. So seed is really a storage organ of protein and carbohydrates that seed has as its first meal as a brand new baby seedling. So the slower it metabolizes those resources, the more energy that seed's going to have to grow into a new baby seedling plant when you plant it.
Mm-hmm. So then they probably also expire over time. Is that correct? Like if seeds are old, do they go bad?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. And again, that's why the places like the Svalbard Seed Vault have sophisticated cold controlled environments, dry and cold again to an extreme, in order to be able to store that seed for a much longer period of time. So the better your seed storage environment, the longer you can store that seed and maintain the quality. but also it needs to be regenerated eventually. And so it's good to keep track of how old the seed that you've saved is. And you don't have to grow everything out every year, but each crop species has a different general number of years that they tend to hold in storage, and keeping track of that is good for making sure that you don't lose those important varieties.
Mm. Wow, there's so much to know. I know you also partner with a couple other organizations for some of the work that you do. Can you tell us about the Carrot Improvement for Organic Agriculture project that you're involved with?
Sure. We partner with a number of public universities across the country to breed new varieties for organic agriculture that have the quality traits that organic farmers need. So in organic production, the ideal is that you're able to grow a robust crop without applying pesticides, without excessive fertility inputs, and different varieties, different genetics will have a different ability to grow robust crop with minimal inputs. And so we partner with public universities, public plant breeders to breed varieties that resist pests and disease, that compete well with weeds, but that also have the kind of flavor and nutritional qualities that we want in the organic eaters world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned our carrot project. We partner with a public plant breeder, Dr. Phil Simon at the University of Wisconsin, along with folks in the University of California, and also at Purdue, a soil scientist, Lori Hoagland, that we work with at Purdue, to breed new varieties of carrots that have weed competitiveness, that have nice, tall, vigorous tops when they grow out of the ground so that they can compete with weeds, and also have disease resistance so that your carrots don't need to be sprayed, and nematode resistance, which is particularly important. Our carrot breeding program has released new varieties of nematode-resistant carrot material in partnership with University of California. And it's particularly important not only for organic farmers, but conventional carrot production in the state of California is particularly chemically intensive and dependent on soil fumigants in order to control nematodes in production. So, and it's an example of how breeding for organic systems has a ripple effect of also supporting less environmental impact in all of our agricultural systems. So we also breed new varieties of novel colors, all of the beautiful purple and yellow mm-hmm. and red carrots, along with our traditional orange carrots. And Phil's program has a long history of improving those novel colors of carrots for their flavor, for their agricultural ability to be able to produce as a crop, and also documenting and evaluating the nutritional quality of those different colors of carrots. And each of those colors is rich in different types of antioxidants. We all know about beta carotene in our orange carrots, but really all of the other colors have different nutritional qualities that are complementary to that beta carotene. There's high in luteins and anthocyanins and various phytonutrients that are important for our health.
I always was wondering that. I assumed it because, you know, I always teach eat like the rainbow, and the more colors that you eat
Absolutely.
In your diet, the more different nutrients and healthful, beneficial vitamins you're going to be getting. And so it just makes sense that different colors would have different vitamins, but I wasn't 100% sure.
Well, carrots are also, I always call carrots the gateway to healthy eating, and they are the vegetable, favorite vegetable of most children, and an easy snack, and, you know, the rainbow of carrots and the nutrition you receive from carrots is an important nutritional complement to our diets, but also a great platform for just getting people to eat more vegetables, period.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So another organization that you partner with is the Northern Organic Vegetable Improvement Collaborative. Can you tell us about their work and what you're doing together?
Yes. This program, we call it NOVIC as an acronym, is really a partnership of several universities and Organic Seed Alliance. It's led by Oregon State University, partnering with University of Wisconsin and Cornell. And together we breed different crops for organic agriculture, organic adaptation. We've worked on, more than six, seven, eight different crop species over the last several years together. And what we do is we partner with each other on evaluating the performance of those different crops in each of our locations, and then we share that information. So we're looking at a wide diversity of different varieties of squash, of tomatoes, of cabbage and corn in each of our states, and then sharing the results of that information. What this does is it allows the plant breeders, we have too few plant breeders in our country. We're so lucky that we still have public plant breeders. This is an important point, that are serving the public good. But we don't have breeders for all crops in all states. So we're able to leverage the resources of a corn breeder in Wisconsin, a tomato breeder in Oregon, a squash breeder in New York, and test their materials across the northern tier of the U.S. so that the varieties, the breeding lines that they're developing, we can see which ones do well for organic farmers in different environments and work together to breed more varieties out of a single breeding program than just Cornell having squash and Wisconsin having corn and Oregon having tomatoes. So it's an example of just a national network, national partnership to work together to breed new varieties for organic farmers. And then we partner with actual organic working farms to test those varieties on farm and solicit feedback and input from organic farmers about what they want and what they're not able to get in organically available seed and varieties that work for their environment.
Mm-hmm. And we're just about out of time. I can't believe I didn't ask you about the farm bill or about some of the public breeding problems. But anyway, it's been wonderful having you, Michaela. Your knowledge is just immense.
You can always follow our website and look at our blog. There's a recent blog post on the Organic Agriculture Research Act. Our website is feedalliance.org, feedalliance.org, and you can learn more about what you can do for the farm bill there.
Wonderful, and I'll post all of your info on my website, too, so everyone can find it there. And I know you have a growing conference coming up, and I'll post that as well. Everyone
great.
Listening, thank you so much. I'm sorry we're rushing when out of time, but it's been great being with you, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you, Michaela.